to be piloting the lunar module wasn't the guy who landed it. So I don't know if he's listening tonight because he asked me this question back in January 3rd, but just in case he is listening, unfortunately I forgot his name and his call sign, but I'm sure he would be interested. I'm sure everyone would be interested with this story.
Okay, very good. Thanks for that, Roy. And yeah, he wanted to try to understand why Buzz Aldrin did not pilot the LEM all the way down to the moon when he was, you know, he was designated lunar module pilot, which is actually a good question. And it turns out that all the six flights that went and landed on the moon all had a lunar module pilot. They also had a commander. And they also had a command module pilot. In the case of Apollo 11, you had Mike Collins as the command module pilot. So his job was to control Columbia. Columbia was the name of the command module. And, you know, he's the guy that stayed in orbit. And so he had a, you know, that was a good designation for him. Aldrin had the title lunar module pilot. Now NASA, you know, when they first started doing this, you know, they came out with the Gemini program, and that's where they first had two people, so they didn't want to call one guy a pilot and the other guy a co-pilot. One guy was always the commander, so the second person, he became the pilot, not the co-pilot. And that held true into the Apollo days. So you would have the commander, in this case Armstrong, and he would be the commander of the whole Saturn V, including the command module, including the LEM. He was the commander. And then you had Michael Collins for the command module pilot, controlled the Columbia in orbit around the moon. And then you had Buzz Aldrin, and they gave him the name of, they didn't want to call him, for instance, the module co-pilot, so they called him the LEM pilot. He could fly this thing just as well as Armstrong did. But he was, when they were landing, Armstrong is on the left-hand side, right near the door. If you had backpacks on, and they were both in spacesuits, if you wanted to reverse that anyway, you couldn't get one guy past the other guy. It was tight quarters. After they landed, so that would have been impossible anyway. But the commander gets the job of landing that vehicle on the moon, and he also has he's the guy that would decide on aborting the mission, not Aldrin. So that's how that all worked out, and it held true all the way into the shuttle times when you had Bob Crippen and John Young go up to do the first flight of the space shuttle, also called Columbia. It was the same deal. Young was the commander. Bob Crippen was the pilot, and that held true through all the missions. When they landed that shuttle on every flight, it wasn't the pilot that was landing, it was the commander. In future flights, a lot of times that pilot was elevated to the commander position, and then he would be landing the shuttle. So that's the story on that. Any questions or comments? This is WS. And I know it's a piece of history. I guess if you search the internet, you'll probably find variations of that whole story. But actually, living through it, I remember them discussing this on practically 24-hour news when they were doing the space missions in the 60s. That was a popular topic. Hey, Buzz, how come you're not landing on the... You're not going to be the one landing the LEM on the moon? But, we actually lived through all those conversations on the nightly news. One of the things I was trying to cover first are the upcoming launches. We have a launch coming up on the 27th, a couple of days from now, and that will be the Starlink 3 mission. And that is a SpaceX Falcon 9 launch from Launch Complex 40 from Florida. And they'll be launching another 60 satellites. So far they have 180 satellites up there. There's going to be another 60 that they could add to that group. And like Roy said, somewhere down the road they plan on having eventually 40,000 satellites. Each one of these satellites weigh 500 pounds. But he's got to launch this this week, and then a couple more weeks from now he plans on another Starlink launch with another 60 satellites, and so on and so forth. All year long, he's scheduling 24 launches. I don't think he's going to make it. He might get up to 18 or 20 Starlink launches, you know, plus other launches, but, you know, just Starlink launches. He might get, you know, 18, let's say, launches this year. Each one with 60 satellites. That will be enough for him to start selling subscriptions to the Starlink program, where you'll be able to, if you sign up, you'll be able to have 4K TV, broadband, you know, computer, and that's all going to probably happen. Probably by the end of the year, they'll start, getting people, maybe companies, to sign up first. Who knows? But the goal is to do this worldwide, and he plans on doing that within a couple of years. He should be able to have enough coverage to do that. So, you know, I guess you won't need cable vision or these other land-based systems that we have. Problem is, I haven't found out the cost. They asked, you know, what's it going to cost? And Elon Musk really doesn't have an answer for that yet. It's going to be competitive. That's his answer. So it should be interesting to see what happens. You know, he's not going to be the only space-based broadband company, but he's going to be the first, from what I say. So, another launch coming up is by the National Reconnaissance Office. That's our government, and that's, you know, that top secret NRO. Always top secret satellites that they normally launch from American soil. They're actually going to launch it from New Zealand. Relatively small satellite, but one of these spy satellites, NROL-151, they call it, will be launched by a rocket lab, an Electron rocket. The Electron rocket has been successful. I think he's up to about 10 launches right now. When I say he, his name is Peter Beck, and he's the one that started Rocket Lab, and he developed this this black carbon fiber rocket. Stands only about 60 or 70 feet tall. He's able to get it to orbit. It's got 9 Rutherford engines attached to the bottom. They all run on turbo pumps all run on electric motors and powered by lithium batteries instead of using, you know, the exhaust or a different system that everybody else uses. He developed this, and he's become successful to the point where he's now opening up another launch complex right here in the United States in Virginia, in Wallops Island. And he expects to have a launch, probably go off there I'm going to say within 3 or 4 months will be probably the first launch for an Electron rocket from the United States. And he plans on launching many, many small satellites. So he's building another launch complex next to the other launch complex in New Zealand. And his goal is to have one launch per week from somewhere. And I think he's going to be able to do that within probably a year or so. I wouldn't be surprised. Last year, I think he had almost 10 launches, and he's probably on track to do maybe 18 or 20 launches this year. So, this is WS-2N, by the way. Another interesting launch coming up would be the Solar Orbiter. It's a European Space Station, European Space Agency spacecraft that they're sending to orbit the Sun, with inside Mercury's orbit. A similar idea to what the United States did a year and a half ago with the Parker solar probe that they sent. That's successfully now orbiting the Sun. European Space Agency wants to do the same thing with the Solar Orbiter, but they hired Boeing and Lockheed collectively to call the United Launch Alliance to launch their Solar Orbiter on an Atlas V rocket. So they'll be doing that on the 7th. Late at night, like 11:15 at night, and they have a two-hour window, I think, so, I mean, it actually might go off early morning on the 8th, but hopefully that works out, and then you could have two solar probes, you know, looking at the Sun, different you know, orbits, and you'll be able to compare the two, and then the scientists will get a lot of information out of the two solar probes. Okay, a couple of EVAs were done last week. Actually, two of them. The first two last week was by two women. It was the third time they went out together to replace batteries on the International Space Station, on the P6 truss section. So it's way out at the end of the fourth side of the space station. So, you know, you do an EVA, you leave the Quest lab, and then you have to go along the truss section all the way to the end, which is, you know, a couple hundred feet away, not about the length of a football field to get to the end. And it was very successful. They were able to move these massive batteries, a brand new lithium battery to replace two other failed nickel hydrogen batteries. Well, they weren't failed, they were due to be replaced, but this has been going on for a couple of years, and they're up to, I think, 36 batteries now that they've changed over the last couple of years, but each time they do it, it's 12, and they pull out 12 and they put in 6 new lithium ion batteries. And each battery weighs like, you know, 400 pounds. It's not, you know, there's a lot of mass to move around, to walk hand over hand all the way to the end, and then install them to where they go. And it's so far out at the end of the space station that they can't use their robotic arm. They're using the robotic arm to actually move some of the battery pallets around. So that's being utilized, so they can't, you know, and they can't attach themselves to it. So they both go out, you know, move it along the truss until they're able to install it. Everything went well until they were trying to get back, and then the two women are Christina Koch and Jessica Meir. And Christina's SAFER unit, there's a housing that started to work its way out of where it's supposed to belong. The SAFER unit is a unit that's attached to their back. You have a big backpack, you know, with all your air and oxygen and everything you need to survive. And then surrounding that, you have something called a safety unit. It's got nitrogen jets on it. Officially, it's called the Simplified Aid for EVA Rescue, SAFER. And that this thing started to come loose. They worked on that for a little bit, fixed it. And then they had some problems with one of the foot restraints that they utilized. And it ate up a little bit more time. So they did 100% of what they wanted to do. Sometimes they try to do a get-ahead work on an EVA. In this case, they did not do that. So, very successful. They got back inside okay. And all is well with those two. And by the way, Christina should be coming back next month. She'll be up there almost a year. Christina Koch, she set all the records and everything. And I think she's only about a week or so away from Kelly's record. He was up there almost a whole year as well. That's what they try to do nowadays, to try to leave people on that space station as long as possible. For two reasons. One, they study them medically, inside and out, and then they also are able to make sure that they have a United States presence on the space station at all times. And for the next couple of months, when they leave, when Christine leaves, there might be a void. They'll have like three astronauts on board instead of six. So that might be the case for maybe three months or maybe even 6 months, depending on how the American launch system goes with either Boeing with the Starliner going up to the space station, bringing the crew of, on a regular basis, they'll be bringing the crew of four up and down. And the same with Dragon, Crew Dragon vehicle. And they're both, they're getting close. They're getting close to launching from American soil. All goes well with at least one of them, I'm expecting to launch probably as early as April, possibly May. We'll send the first, anyway, probably two people from SpaceX on the crew Dragon vehicle. And if it turns out that Boeing is first, they plan on sending three up right away on that first mission. That's the story with that. Any questions or comments on that EPA? Okay, we had another EVA that successfully was done by Luca Pomitano. He's an ESA, European Space Agency astronaut, but he's trained by NASA. And he comes out of Italy. This is his second flight up there. And he did an EVA with Andrew Morgan, and Luca Pomitano, successfully went out and finished rebuilding the AMS, the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer. And that's the, I call it a telescope, but really it's a detector of the, on top of the space station. You know, it's probably as big as an SUV. And it looks at the sky, and it looks for positrons and electrons, exotic particles as they're flying through space. And this is a $2 billion unit that was only supposed to last a couple of years. And since it's so successful and they like it so much, we need more time with this. And it wasn't really made to be serviceable, but a lot cheaper to try to service this thing than it is to send up another one. They have four of these cooling pumps, and eventually they all failed. Well, three failed, the other one was intermittent. So they sent up four new pumps in this big rack, and they attached a rack to the outside of the space station, and they had all these cooling tubes coming off the you know, these stainless steel tubes that would be used for cooling, hooked already up to the new pumps. And the goal was to disconnect all the old pumps and pipe in these four new pumps. So over a period of four EVAs, they were able to do that. First one, they went out, set things up, set up handrails, different foot rails, you know, taking panels off, getting ready to do whatever they had to do. And the second EVA, after that, they actually got out there and were able to mount pumps, get ready, and eventually they cut all the lines, capped them all off, and now this final EVA, they went out and they wanted to check for leaks, make sure everything was held, you know, holding tight. And apparently the, you know, from Earth, from Mission Control, they're actually able to energize the system. And there's some kind of chemical in there that, if it leaks, it comes out, you see like a little red dye, a little red trace coming out on near one of the stainless steel tubes that they had cut previously and reconnected. And there were a total of eight of these that they had to check, make sure, you know, eight joints that were done. And seven of them were good, but number five, sure enough, that showed a leak. These are all carbon dioxide refrigeration type systems. So they, you know, they had an alternative plan in practice for this. Luca Parmitano was able to give the nut, you know, another, you know, maybe quarter of a turn. And they have these, and they turn it with a wrench. They have 7/18 open-end wrench. By the way, 7/18 wrench is the most common size of anything on in space. No matter what satellite you're at, a Hubble Space Telescope, it's one of the most common sizes. They planned that many years ago. So they tighten it, and then they look at it, and then they have to check within an hour to see if that thing's leaking. Sure enough, it was leaking again. So the astronauts were told to, well, tighten it up one more time. They tell them how far to go. And we're going to wait, again, one more hour to see what happens. But since, you saw a leak already, it didn't work the first time, go back and prepare for a jumper setup. So during this next hour, they went back to Quest Lab, and they retrieved a contingency setup, which involved a jumper piece, you know, another stainless steel tubing that they could use to bypass this whole leaky problem. But it turns out they didn't need to do that. When they came back after that 1 hour, Luca Parmitano, he checked to see if there was any red dye, and there was no red dye. So they declared that a success, and I guess they're going to put that into operation again. Hopefully, that goes well. Let me drop it. Any other questions or comments for the net? This is WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. I'm going to wait for Echo, IRLP with the earlier conversation I heard. That is not in operation right now. Hopefully they get that working for next week. There's another telescope that's been terrific for all the scientists all these years. Besides the Hubble Space Telescope, they call them the four great observatories. One was the Hubble Space Telescope. Another one, the Compton Gamma Ray Observatory. And then the other one, another one that's still operating, is the Chandra X-ray Observatory. That's the one that goes, goes like two-thirds of the way to the moon and then comes back around near Earth and keeps doing that over and over again. But there's another one called the Spitzer Telescope. They have finally decided to deactivate Spitzer. Spitzer was named after Lyman Spitzer. He was the one that conceived originally of putting a space telescope into space before I was born in the 1940s. He came up with this. So he was a real old-timer. And he got the credit for this idea of putting a telescope in space, having it steady enough, and being able to point. And, I guess people might have thought he was nuts at the time, but as time went by, they sure enough thought this was a great idea. They put some earlier telescopes up in the air in space in the 60s. I guess kind of like a proof of concept system. But then eventually they got the idea of developing the Hubble Space Telescope. So although the Hubble was named after Hubble himself, you know, the guy who came up with the theory of the expansion of the universe, the father of the Hubble Space Telescope is really Lyman Spitzer. So to make everybody happy as the years went by, sure enough, when they launched the Spitzer Telescope, launched in 2003 or something, they named it after Spitzer, and it's an infrared telescope. It's in heliosynchronous orbit, so it's really following Earth. As Earth goes around the sun, this thing is also going around the sun, and it's actually drifting further and further away from Earth as, you know, every day that goes by. So it's been up there for years, very successful. It did have a lot of helium on board to keep everything cool. Eventually, the coolant ran out in 2009, but, you know, some of the other instruments were still working, so they used it. And now, it's, you know, what has happened is it's gone so far away from Earth that, you know, it has solar panels, and it needs to raise the solar panels towards the sun, and at the same time it needs to point the antenna to the Earth. And they never planned on using it this long, and, you know, the architecture of this whole system, they're unable to do both. And each time, each year goes by, they're able to use it less and less. So they finally decided to stop using the Spitzer Telescope. So it's coming to a grinding halt, but they're going to take all the science that was learned from it, and they have many, many discoveries using Spitzer, including there was one planet system. I think it had seven planets going around a star. I think this was the one that got involved with that. But they'll wind up taking the James Webb Space Telescope, which will launch in 2021, next year, March. And James Webb will be able to follow up on a lot of the work that Spitzer did, as well as the other telescopes like TESS. We have TESS that's now looking for planets. And all the information from all these space telescopes will eventually be, you know, given over to the scientists that are handling James Webb, and I'm sure we'll get plenty of results from that thing, if that thing ever works. But that's a massive contraption. That telescope is as big as a tennis court. So hopefully that gets off the ground next year. Any questions or comments? This is WS2N. Okay, earlier I was talking to Roy about the MOXIE unit that's going to be put on the Mars 2020 rover, which is going to be launched this summer. The believe in July, and land early next year, probably, I guess, January or maybe early February of next year. And, you know, as I call it, the Mars 2020 rover, because it doesn't have a name yet. NASA, over the decades, has always wanted to name the, these different spacecraft, and what they usually do is they'll look for a student out there, in, you know, out there in some school somewhere, and in this case, usually from kindergarten all the way to the 12th grade. And they'll have write essays, and they'll submit the essays of, you know, what name that they should choose. So out of the thousands of people that have sent in the, you know, I think there's almost 30,000 young people that sent in essays. They chose 9 people, and out of the 9 names, they plan on choosing that name in March. Whoever wins gets a free trip to watch the Mars 2020 rover take off. But if you go to the NASA website, they have, you can click on this, you can bring it up, and you can see the names that they've chosen, and you can vote on which one you like, you know. So you pick one and you vote on it, and you might help name it. And the names that they have are Endurance, Tenacity, Promise, Perseverance, Vision, Clarity, Fortitude, and Courage. So, pick one. And, you know, you pick one and you just click on it, and off it goes. I liked Endurance. That sounded good. We'll see which one they pick. It'll be one of those 9. I look forward to finding out what they're going to call this thing in March. I'm tired of calling it the 2020 rover. 2020 Mars rover. Let me drop it. Okay. Let's see. Where I was talking about Boeing. Boeing had a contract with DARPA. DARPA is the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, and Boeing was going to develop the X-1 rocket. They plan on having this rocket. It looked like the first stage was going to be it was going to have wings on it, and it was going to launch, and then it was going to be I think cargo bays or some, maybe an attachment to the vehicle, and it was there that would have detached, and that part would have gone into orbit, and the rest of it would have came back and landed on a runway. So it would have launched like a rocket vertical takeoff, but not vertical landing. It was going to come back and land as a regular plane. So for some reason, I don't know what, maybe they have some problems. Like Roy said, they dropped the contract with DARPA. It was going to be called the Phantom Express. You know, I mean, they're working on it. It was going to have 2 of these engines, very similar to what a space shuttle main engine has. Space shuttle main engine, they're called RS-25 engines. This is going to be the AR-22 engine. So it's going to be built by Aerojet Rocketdyne, and they're going to use their engines. That's not to be. It was going to be 90 feet long. It was going to have like this, like 50-foot wingspan. You know, it was interesting. So whether or not DARPA tries to get somebody else involved in this to pick up the slack, I don't know. But they, you know, their goal is to have the capability of launching satellite in space like overnight. The goal of the X-10 was going to be able to put up like 10 launch 10 different times in one day. I mean, I mean, that's the DARPA's goal. I guess they feel if, you know, there's also some kind of catastrophic event that occurs with all these satellites, they would need to be able to put satellites into space at a very quick pace. So that was another Boeing deal. Let me drop it. Talking about the Mars rover, Curiosity, sitting on Mars since, what, 2012 now, it landed. So it's, 7 years up there, driving around in Gale Crater. You know, it's doing good, and I mean, it's got worn-out wheels. You know, the tires are in bad shape, but it's still doing good. They know how to get it from place to place without doing any further damage to their wheels. It does run on a RTG, a radioisotope thermoelectric generator, so it's got plenty of power. If there's any more global dust storms that really killed our last rover there, Opportunity, because that was solar panel. So, you know, this one don't have that problem. This one is running by, you know, nuclear power. It's doing well, except for the other day it was, you know, doing a job, and you know, it's got this long 7-foot arm that can reach out. It's able to drill rocks, do, you know, take pictures, and, you know, all kinds of different things with this one rock, arm that is able to pick up rocks, pick up samples. Everything's just locked up. Everything froze, not temperature-wise, but just everything stopped because the computer all of a sudden decided that it didn't know where it was located. It didn't know if it was facing up, down, sideways. It didn't know if it was on a tilt. So everything just stopped. And this went on for a couple of days. And luckily today I read the engineers. Worked it out. Apparently they had a similar problem years ago with the same vehicle. And they have something happens with the memory on the computer. And they do have a backup memory, backup computer system. So if something like this happens, they're able to switch from one to the other. Apparently that's what they did. And now they're good to go again. And then they tried to figure out, you know, what went wrong and send up a couple of commands to make sure it doesn't happen again. Any comments or questions? This is WS2N. Nothing hurt. I've probably talked about 20 different types of rockets that we launch presently. Probably twice that amount. Other rockets that we've launched that we don't launch anymore, but there's one that I haven't talked about that much called Firefly. It hasn't launched yet, but they expect it to launch very shortly. They're calling it the Alpha rocket, so it's a basic name. Launched by the company Firefly. Firefly was in business, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, and then it was doing okay, and then they weren't. From what I understand, I think they were about to, or maybe they did file bankruptcy before anything really bad happened. Somebody else bought them up, and now they're actually improving the rocket engine. You know, they call it the Reaver engine. There's going to be four engines on each of the first stage of the vehicle, and then there'll be a second stage, and they'll be able to launch, you know, maybe up to 1,500 pounds to orbit, which is a lot more than, you know, some of the other smaller rocket providers. So Firefly is coming along, but The plan was to launch from Vandenberg Air Force Base this April. but on a test stand down in Texas, they are filling up the tanks with liquid oxygen, and they wound up with a fire near the pad. Just out of precaution, they evacuated people in the nearby area. I guess there's a town nearby, so they made sure that everybody was far enough away in case this thing blew. It didn't blow. Apparently, they have a extinguishing system, which puts fire out, and now they're good to go again. But I think they're going to be back on track within a couple of weeks, and maybe again a possible launch from this new vehicle from California, and maybe, I'm going to say probably May now, but they've increased the amount of employees they have. Now they're over 500 people working for them. I think they've quadrupled that number recently. So I'm going to be watching that company. Some company I never heard of bought them up. It's called New Sphere Benches. Never heard of them, but apparently they must have enough money to keep this company afloat. This is WS2M. Talked about the space station before, Ares, amateur radio on International Space Station, who's in charge of having NASA have contacts with the students, are taking more applications now. Then they have webinars. You know, if you apply, you get onto the webinar, and they talk to you and let you know, what you find out what your school is about, or you're able to fill out all the forms and everything, and eventually they choose a school, and then if you're lucky enough, they'll do it. Worked out for a school that I was involved with one time, and it's very interesting to have students in an auditorium being able to talk to an astronaut as they're orbiting Earth. So they are now taking applications. If you're involved with a school system, the Ares program is the way to go. Let me drop it. And then going back to the abort system that SpaceX has with their Crew Dragon vehicle. A week or so ago, they tested their in-flight abort system, and the results came back. And from what I see, everything worked perfectly. You know, they had a perfect launch of a Falcon 9 rocket from Launch Complex 39A in Florida. It got up to, I think, around 1,200 miles per hour, and, you know, over the speed of sound, up to what they call maximum Q, where you have the most pressure on the vehicle at the time. And they duplicated an abort system as if there was a crew on board. They had two dummies on board with all kinds of sensors and everything. And the Super Draco engines fired off. They got up to around 140,000 pounds per square inch, give you an idea. Alan Shepard went up with his Redstone rocket. It was a suborbital flight, but he went up and came down, and that was around 70,000. So just the Super Draco engines themselves, which are encapsulated inside the crew vehicle itself, is able to put out twice that amount of thrust. Got away from the booster inside of seconds. It was like a mile away. The booster has sensors on board, and it shows that it's out of control, and it automatically detonates itself. They have explosives in there, and that thing just blew up. But if there was a crew in there, everything would have been fine. It got to apogee, a point where where there's like no gravity. I mean, it was like, it went up like 12, 13 miles up. The trunk separated from the crew vehicle. You know, the trunk is part of the Dragon system. If it was going to the space station, it would have like equipment or satellites, or, you know, things that unpressurized stuff that would go to the space station. So that separates, and then you just have the heat shield look. Regular thrusters. Regular small thrusters, you know, maybe with a 100-pound thrust capability is 18 of them on that, on a crew vehicle. Reoriented the spacecraft to the proper attitude, heat shield down, and as it was coming down, the drogue chutes popped out, two small drogue chutes popped out, and that goes for about a minute or so, and then eventually the drogue chutes pull out the four main parachutes. Each main parachute was like 118 feet in diameter. So four of these red and white things opened up, and it came back and landed in the Atlantic Ocean. With that, they have the ship called the Searcher. Not military, it's Ghost Searcher is by SpaceX, able to pick up the Dragon vehicle and bring it back safely to Cape Canaveral, check it all out, make sure there's no leaks, you know. And everything, from what the report that came out from NASA, from SpaceX, that it all worked good. Now, because of that, SpaceX has really finished all their main tests. They don't have any big tests left for NASA, and they'll probably launch a crew, my guess, probably April. The crew vehicle that they'll be flying, I think, should be here in early mid-February, and then they'll just work on it, get everything ready, and eventually put it on top of an Atlas V booster and blast it into space to go to the International Space Station. So that's the deal on that. Did want to cover that, and that's pretty much it. So, does anybody have any questions or comments for this portion of the TechNet call, the SpaceNet report? Nothing heard, so I guess we'll close down, and we'll be back here next week. You know, hopefully everybody stays well. Keep away from people with the flu. And we'll be back here again. I'm going to turn it over to Roy and see if he has a few words. I didn't have any pictures for you tonight, Roy. I did have one picture. I'll probably send over next week. A human standing next to the different size engines that I keep talking about. You know, what does it look like if you stand next to a SpaceX Dragon Merlin engine, or you know, the bigger BE-4 engine that Amazon with Blue Origin is going to use, or next to the bigger F-1 engine that the Apollo people use. I'm going to send those pictures over to you, I think, during the week. Maybe we'll put them up for next week. Over to you, Roy. AC2GS, this is WS2N for the SpaceNet report of the TechNet.
Thanks a lot, Paul, and I look forward to those pictures, and when I get them, I'll put them on the website. I put all the articles that I mentioned, including the one with the Legos of the ISS, on roy.ac2gs.com, and so anyone can click at it, and there's the articles on nano-DNA, and there are some Amazon links if people are interested in those BNC to SMA converters. They don't give you 100% strain relief, but in some cases I find them very useful. You just have to know your equipment's limitations and such. And as always, I want to remind everyone that if you have any questions mailbag questions that you'd like to ask Dick, but you can't get onto the technical net. Or if you have any questions that you'd like to pose to Paul or have him read an article and make a comment, or if you have a topic that you would like me to discuss or a puzzle that you've heard that sounds like it would fit my usual puzzles, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. That's the email address. And the link page, as always, is roy.ac2gs.com. And as always, I want to thank everyone who participated, and even those who just sat there and listened as I droned on. And especially want to thank those people that showed up during my little talk on test equipment at Ham Radio University with Andy, WA2CDL. It was a fun time, and I hope the people that attended had as much fun as we had. So I just want to thank everyone, wish everyone well, and as Paul said, common sense approach to infectious disease. People coughing, people sneezing, people not looking terribly good. As long as you're not a physician, stay away from them, unless they're loved ones, then you got to take care of them. But keep things as sterile as you can, wash your hands regularly, cover your face, cover every bit that you can cover. And I wish you good luck and have a health and happy 2020. Let me see if Dick is back on the radio. He'd like to shut it down for tonight.
No, but we'll all be back on next week. I'll say 73, everybody. And tomorrow is the club info net. So on these repeaters. Don't have to be a member to check in. And you can find out what this club is involved with. They're very active. 73, have a good day.
Boys, 73 to everyone. And this is AC2GS going clear. Until next week, guys.
Tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. The time is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Good morning. The time is 5:00 a.m. This is the W2VL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater. net tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater.
K2MJT, name is Mike, mobile in Malvern. K2MJT mobile, looking for a coronavirus update. K2MJT, Southern State traffic westbound, all backed up to the Cross Island Parkway North. Don't know why. K2MJT, reporting eastbound traffic on the Southern State at a standstill to the merge of Cross Island North. Make that westbound Southern State. K2MJT mobile.
WV2ZSE, W8CDL, you have station.
K2MJT mobile. MJT northbound on the Clearview in Queens.
N1 YDY Mobile 2.
Mobile, where are you at?
This is Hank, and I'm in Fort Washington. Who's this?
Okay. This is Mike. I'm heading up on the Long Island Expressway in Flushing, Queens.
Okay, Mike, what's your call?
K2MJT.
Very good, sir. Well, I'm inching my way in local traffic here. Just a little local spot where it always bunches up. And the person I'm following got through the light and I didn't. So I'm going to have to play a little bit of catch-up to pick them up. They're dropping a car off at a mechanic to get it serviced. No big deal, but I just would have liked to have been right behind her.
Roger that. I'm headed off to Flushing, which is another few miles down the road to go to work. I'm a little apprehensive. I'm probably very paranoid with the virus count in the news.
Yeah, Flushing is, I could easily see why you would be a little bit concerned by working in Flushing and the coronavirus.
Yeah, I'll be in a highly populated area every day, so I don't know, I'll play it by ear.
What do you do for work, if you don't mind my asking?
I'm in a college and a lot of